Movie Mavericks.
The Movie Mavericks Podcast.
Movie Mavericks, speaking of fucking long, uncut European cocks.
The Movie Mavericks Podcast.
Now for your hosts, Jason and Trevor.
I can't wait.
Hey now, everybody, welcome to a special episode of the Movie Mavericks Podcast. This is our retrospective episodes, a new little spin-off in the Movie Mavericks that we're going to be doing regularly, episodes of talking about older movies from our youth. Unfortunately, these spin-offs, you do get the main characters from the original. Trevor Anderson, hi. Jason Beauregard, hello, sir.
Hello, good to be here. Glad to be talking about this movie, which was such an inspiration to me as a kid. One of my all-time favorites growing up. I saw this many, many times, and you can probably tell by the music that we played on the lead-in. This is going to be talking about 1989's Batman, the first Tim Burton superhero collaboration. And really, watching this, I thought this was setting the template, the mold, the groundbreaking mold, I felt, for all the superhero films that would come in its wake up until 2008's Dark Knight, which reset the mold once again for all the superhero films.
You don't think today. Iron Man?
Iron Man and Dark Knight came out in the same summer, so that can be...
I know, but I'm just saying, I mean, wouldn't you think more than Iron Man? I mean, I agree that the Dark Knight set tone for a lot of other movies other than comic book movies.
Yeah.
But really, for comic book movies nowadays, there's no other tone than Marvel, right?
I guess I would concede
that. But if you are talking about DC movies, I'd say Superman, 10 years earlier than this Batman movie, is really the movie that set the mold for these DC things going forward. And even for Batman itself is really based on Superman.
And Superman was the only superhero film or cartoon film, comics film, that had been successful up until this point. Popeye had failed miserably, the Altman, Robin Williams calamity, and now you had Batman, which was really a gamble up until this point because the only reference point had been the 1966 campy television show. So people really had no idea what to expect from this. I know this is well documented.
And they were a little weary of it.
Yeah, Keaton especially. I mean, you tell people that you're going to take a darker approach, and then you cast an actor who's best known for his comedic roles. Yeah.
And you had Tim Burton directing.
The irony here to me when I look at this is that you put the comedic actor, Keaton, in what would be the serious role, and you put the serious actor, Nicholson, in what you'd think would be the comedic role.
I know, right?
But doesn't that give it some sort of bearing in a sense too, because these worlds are so backwards and it's not what you'd expect.
Maybe. I mean, we can talk about that. I don't even want to talk about that now, or we get into the movie.
We'll get into
more,
that a little
that's
bit.
Because
yeah.
That's a deep, deep seated issue, I think, with this movie, actually.
Yeah, but off the top here, let's talk about its reference points here historically. This movie, when it did debut in June 19th of 1989, I don't know about you, but I remember seeing this opening day. It's when I was only 10 when this came out, so I came out of a summer class or whatever, and my aunt took me to go see this. We had somebody waiting in line. First time I really remember lines around the block for something and people just really dying to get in to see this. And this was very dark and adult. Even at 10, it was a little... I didn't quite understand all the things that were happening in this movie. Did you see this in the theater or did you catch this on VHS?
I don't remember.
You can't go that far back. I am a little older than you, so...
I don't... You're 1 year older than me. I don't remember, to be honest with you. I remember the movie, but I don't remember how I saw it.
When this did debut, it had the opening weekend record. At the time, it was $40 million, which is adjusted somewhere in the $80 million range, $80-plus million. But they didn't have that many screens back then. But this did have the biggest opening
2,000
day.
2,000 screens it played on, I think. So,
biggest opening day ever, biggest Saturday ever, biggest Sunday ever up to that point. And so, obviously, the biggest weekend ever. But up in that summer of 89, that opening weekend record had been broken twice previously, once by Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, once by Ghostbusters, and then by Batman. But people were flocking to sequels that summer.
Yeah.
So Batman came along, right? But this is the movie I always think of 89. And of that summer, a hell of a summer, really, with Lethal Weapon 2, Indiana Jones 3, and Batman. Of those three, I think I picked this one as my favorite of those three. What would you say to that?
Gun to my head? Is that what you're talking about? I think Last Crusade, maybe. I liked a little better.
But isn't that a hell of a summer for movies right there?
That's a hard pick. Yeah, they're so different.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, this was, though, considered dark for the time. And you do have to say that for the time, don't you? Because it's really not dark at all anymore.
No, it's really light. As I rewatched this, and especially that last sequence in the cathedral, but everyone talked about how dark it was. Now, I remember watching this on VHS as a kid and thinking, yeah, it's really dark because they didn't pump it up enough. But now with crystal clear HD and whatnot, it's beautifully shot. And so you can actually see what's going on. But theaters with dim bulbs back in the day, this was very, very dark in theaters. Now, talking a little bit about the production, Burton here was really just coming off of Beetlejuice. But if you look at his run, this is really, to me, his golden era. He had Beetlejuice, Batman, Edward Scissorhands. Then he goes on to do Batman Returns and Ed Wood. In that run there, I don't think he ever made anything that would touch what he did in that era, to me. Especially with the Beetlejuice, Batman, and Edward Scissorhands, undoubtedly.
Well, and to be fair, like Batman wouldn't have happened had not, Pee-wee's Big Adventure and Beetlejuice been such a big hit. So, for all the worry about Burton helming this thing, it was his past successes that made this happen.
And everyone was concerned because he really was a guy who only focused in the art departments was his main concern, I should say. But this is rewatching it. Wouldn't you say this is kind of old fashioned filmmaking in a lot of ways? I don't get a very comic book vibe from a filmmaking technique from this. I get a German expressionist film noir, that kind of stuff, obviously. But kind of a more straightforward approach, I thought, than the zany comic book type angles and tilts and things that we'd go on to see, and especially in Dick Tracy and things that would follow in its footsteps, Rocketeer, The Shadow, you know, things like that.
Yeah, but I mean, that's Tim Burton, right? I mean, he was never, I don't know. He doesn't necessarily over-direct.
Yeah, it's true.
Would never say that about him.
He's got the Kevin Smith touch.
Yeah, he does. Sometimes he's good with the camera, but mostly he does just shoot things. I look at Beetlejuice, it's very straightforwardly shot, you know. Beautiful set design, though, and just like this movie.
This movie does have some beautiful, beautiful set design in this. Anton Furst won the Academy Award for his production design here, and the Batmobile itself was just reimagined. And I still think this is, in this first film, is the best incarnation of the Batmobile. I don't think they ever as right as here.
Well, I mean, it's no wonder that the new Batmobile in Superman versus Batman looks like a mix of this Batmobile and the Tumbler, you know, because really gearing more towards this. This is the one of the most iconic cars ever.
Yeah, it really is. And I mean, even the green headlights, the yellow headlights give it something, that black and yellow combined, you know, it's the color of the bat suit in the emblem and whatnot. And the emblem, just the cover art, that logo, is one of the greatest pieces of modern graphic art. I mean, that logo says it all, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so very simplistic.
Yeah, but beautiful, and you can't really take your eyes off it either. Now, I just said Batman had set the opening weekend record, this first one, but two other films in the Batman franchise would also set opening weekend records. Batman Forever would set the record in 1995, and then, of course, The Dark Knight reset the record in 2008 to be outdone later by the Avengers. But so the Batman films have always been extremely popular. Even when they've been considered underperformers like Batman and Robin, they still, in adjusted money, make a lot of money. So this was always the character that has saved Warner Brothers, really. And once again, they've gone to him to help out Superman with this Superman versus Batman. There's a reason they've included Batman into the fold to get this, you know, Superman franchise that they've got off the ground, because Man of Steel was not working. But back to this one. Let's talk about the movie, obviously, here. Let's get into the bones of the movie.
Oh, you want to talk about the movie?
You want to talk about Batman? I'm here to talk about Batman.
I mean, yeah, so what do you want to do? You want to just talk about the first act, which has absolutely nothing to do with Batman?
Well, there's a reason that Batman is seen in the first glimpse there, that they put in that superficial fight with the bums or the muggers, because they have to have an appearance by him, because he doesn't make another appearance till nearly 30 minutes.
It's almost a horror movie starring Jack Napier
Jack Nicholson playing Jack Napier.
Right. Exactly. And Batman, cause not Bruce Wayne. Right. But Batman, is like the monster in a way. If this were a monster movie, that would be how. Wait, the monster makes a thing, and then you get the setup of the main character guy who's going to fight the monster.
this is what I got about that first act as well. With the way that Nicholson was dressed in the gangster, I didn't know if that was supposed to be some sort of homage to Chinatown or Princey's Honor, which he had recently done, the whole gangster thing that he'd done, and Jack Palance is there, overacting, very overacting in this scene. And then they show Bruce Wayne, and he comes off as this Gatsby-type figure who's really aloof, not nearly the billionaire playboy that you see later in the Kilmer or the Clooney incarnations, mm-hmm. or even the Bale ones. You know, they've really pushed up the loner aspect on this one. Although I will say that I like Alfred. I'll take this old codger over Michael Caine any day. I really like Penny's work in this one.
Yeah.
I like this actor. But you're right, the first act, the problem with this movie to me, and obviously it starts in the first act, is they have no real story to tell here. So structurally,
there's zero story in this movie.
Structurally, though, it's on point. I mean, he turns in from at the end of the first act, Napier is in that canister.
I'm going to disagree that it's on point. I think it's 2 hours for a reason, and that's because the half an hour of it is story that isn't backstory, that isn't really set up, that's given to us as set up, and we don't need it. And it's really this Napier story is what we don't need. I mean, it's 17 minutes in before we see the scene you're talking about, where we see Alfred and Bruce Wayne for the first time at the party.
When you first meet,
we've
Knox.
Met the other people. We've met Vicky Vale before then.
Right.
It's ridiculous.
And you've met Vicky Vale and you meet Knox. Right, now Kim Basinger is a babe in this movie. Is she not? I mean, is this not her
good
most
Lord, yeah.
She's most great. Gorgeous? I mean, really, this was her most to me, it's her most beautiful on screen. She looks absolutely luscious in each one of her scenes in this movie. But Alexander Knox is the reporter played by Robert Wool. To me, he's the everyman, the audience point of view in the story. He's the entry point, really the most normal character in the
not
whole
really.
Movie.
He's not really in the movie. So
but he's the, most,
I'm
he's
gonna,
the only
I'm
normal person.
Tell
he's got
you,
a normal job.
It doesn't matter because he's hardly in the movie. What's the point? I don't think there are viewpoints in this movie.
I think his character got shortchanged somewhere in there because I think there was a little bit
I'll
more.
Agree
because
with that because he's not in the movie.
Yeah,
he's in the beginning. He's in the opening act, and then he kind of pops up here and there. To be like, hey, I'm a reporter. Vicky Vale, you're a reporter too, right? Don't you have something to report on? Do you got Batman? You got a report on Batman? No? Maybe? I don't know. Okay, I'll go away. It's like, what the hell?
I want to bring up one shot that's always bothered me in that first act. And in fact, it's in the first appearance that we ever see of Batman. It's before we see him descend down. It's when he's on the rooftop and he turns around and we see the cowl in the shadow. Is that animation? Why is that so jerky? That has looked like shit.
Yeah, it looks
since,
like
that has always looked bad. Yeah, I could never understand why that looks so bad.
I mean,
bad.
It might be.
It never played, even in 89. But, you know, right away you can see the production values there. You can see the sets are there. And they go to the old standby of using the abandoned Access chemical plant, which is there is one shot in that first act that I really like. There's actually two shots. There's one that
Access.
I like. Yeah, of when Jack Nicholson as Jack Napier is right before when the cops are coming and he's throwing wheels and spinning gadgets and there's shit blowing up and it looks like the mad scientist laboratory that's exploding. It looks like something out of Frankenstein.
That is a neat little thing.
It's a nice little shot. It's very Burton-esque.
Pulling all the levers.
Right. And he's kind of, you know, it's like that Mad Hatter, mad scientist moment. And I thought that's like, that could use more of it in that sequence.
But isn't that part of this movie has a lot of that in it, especially with the Jack Napier character. It never does this with Batman, but he does, he's very, it's almost like the 60s Batman in a way. Like it's a little cartoony.
But Batman's grounded in reality the whole time.
But do you think they do that to kind of ease, because that's what people kind of knew?
It had to be. That could be the only, because they didn't, the first time you saw Joker taken as a serious individual was in the opening moments of The Dark Knight, which is why that works so well, you know, when he comes out of nowhere, slams the guy's head on the pen.
And that is in this movie though as well, right? Instead of a pencil this time, it's a hand buzzer.
Right. But it's played way more for laughs.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's played way more for laughs than this, than in the other one. You know, in the other one, he's a psychopath. In this, he's a psychopath with a smile. And because it's Jack Nicholson, we can laugh at it and we can feel comfortable watching this person do these things, you know.
What's your other favorite one?
I really like the shot of Knox paying the cop for the tip. because that shows you right off the bat, and I know it's a nothing shot, but it's an insert, and it shows you right out of the way that, like, everybody can be bought, that the city is screwed. I mean, the city's facing bankrupt, that the cops are getting paid left and right anyway. So it sets the tone for the fact that there is a need for a Batman and what's going on here. So I appreciate those things in the first act. Now, leading into the second act, the scene where Napier is becoming Joker and he's in that really grungy, disgusting surgery room. I love that scene.
That's one of my favorite scene, all-time scenes. Yeah, I remember as a kid seeing that, just being like, oh my God, this is awesome.
Does that not represent the German expressionist that is in that's in the movie? I mean, with the dirty walls and the stark lighting and even the German accent on the doctor, it's something – I mean, it's very, very – it's just atmospheric. It's one of my favorite sequences in the whole film, like you said.
Yeah, well, I'm really of all time. It's just so I don't know. I don't know why I like it so much. It's really not that special of a scene, but maybe just as a kid having seen that, you know, it's just cool. I don't know.
And there's so many ways this movie could have failed too. I mean, with the
there's
casting.
So many ways it pretty much did, right? Well, there's just nothing else.
Let's keep progressing through this.
It's kind of not fair because there's really nothing else like this at the time. You know, to be fair, and I still love this movie, even regardless of the campiness and all the problems that it has. But I'm still not gonna, you know, I'm gonna tell you what they are still, right?
Let me ask you this. Go ahead.
Because we've been talking about Michael Keaton, we've been talking a little about the actors, and if you were making a Batman movie, and you were looking to cast, you would cast Bruce Wayne before you would cast Batman, right? That's who you'd be casting, right? Because clearly, when you look at Michael Keaton, you think of Bruce Wayne, and when he gets into the bat suit, he is Batman, right?
Right.
But you think of him as Bruce Wayne first. That's where the real acting is going to happen, right?
But in this, which would you think? But Burton says he cast him for his eyes for Batman. But the irony there is that Bruce Wayne is in it far more than Batman, especially in this first.
Well, the eyes are really. I mean, they shoot and they light the eyes really well in this, and you can. And the acting of the eyes behind the mask from Keaton is outstanding. Really, I think.
Let's progress though through the second act now.
Sure.
So now we have everybody up to speed. We have Vicki Vale involved in. Love interest subplot with
she loves
Bruce Wayne.
Batman.
Alexander Knox is a little jealous. This is her coworker. Now he's about to get written out of the script.
Well, Joker is the Joker, right?
We are moving forward, and the Joker's plan to take over and kill all of his
Carl
opposition.
Grissom is about to be killed, who is played by Jack Palance, and he's running the show. And then you know, Napier was just his underling. So there's an interesting line of dialogue that I thought comes into play here when he kills Grissom in a very funny, ridiculous way, right?
What line?
Over a woman, are you insane?
I love that line as well. I'm
Great
glad you
line.
Picked up on that.
Is it a prelude of what's to come as well? I think so, in a big, big way, because that's really what that's like the main theme of the fucking movie. That's what this movie's all about. Over a woman, are you insane? Yes. And then it goes on and on, right? Over a woman, over Vicki Vale.
Right, because he's insane, and he can't let it go. I got the two, and I didn't pick that up when I was a kid, but as watching that, and I love the way that Nicholson played that line. You know, when he kind of stomps, it seems like he just can't believe it. He's beside himself that he set up over a woman, and then he emerges from the shadow. That's all done very well with the circus type theme at that point from Elfman, and it kind of blows the whole thing up. But the movie at that point almost comes to a standstill with this very stilted. Relationship or dating scene between between Vale and Wayne, and they do a very hard job of not a very good job really of trying to set up this romantic angle and the fact that Wayne is still emotionally distant, doesn't want to connect with her, and
but it's just very straightforward again, isn't it? I mean, the long table, they're seated at the two ends, this is how they meet. It moves on to them leaving that room, going into the kitchen where they're regaled by Alfred's, you know, tales, and their plates are now close together. They're eating. He's opened up to her. He's let her in, right? All without actually doing anything, right? Without having any real meaning to it,
right?
But in a very visual way, which is an issue I think that Burton has, you know, which later on he kind of fixes in some ways, but he's got trouble showing emotion through characters in his films, does he not?
That's always been the knock on Burton. And when he's done it right, you get something like Ed Wood, which I think is very emotional.
Yes, and I'd almost more attribute that to Johnny Depp's performance, though, than really anything else. But again, here, like I say, I mean, this, it's just such a dun-dun-dun. Look, they're spread apart. Oh, look, their plates are together. She's opening up. But nothing's happened. You know, I mean, no one would, in that 5 minutes screen time that this all happens, they're in love. You know, it's over. They're a couple.
The payoff to this little dating scene to me is the fact that she wakes up in the middle of the night, yes, and he is hanging upside down,
which is an awesome shot.
Yeah, you know, kind of like with the him, bat.
Yeah, he's hanging upside down like in one of those exercise things,
stretching you back, hang upside down. Things, yeah.
I don't know. It's hard to tell exactly what it is, but yeah, right.
It's a very 80s concept to begin with, those stretching upside down machines, you know.
But again, you know, Burton playing to his strengths, you know, just framing a static shot and having it look like a beautiful painting, something you would want to hang on the wall. And that's really his strength.
Now, from there, the movie moves into Nicholson now as full-on Joker. And the problem is that he's Joker. Give him something to do. This scene now gives him something to do.
The boardroom scene you're talking about?
No, I'm talking about where he decides that Batman is stealing all of his press and that he needs to go after him. Now, that scene is only in there to set up a false antagonistic relationship between the two, because nothing there's no reason to relate them. The fact that Joker's only mad at Batman because the press seems to be afraid of Batman.
You're talking about when he notices Vicki Vale?
No, when he slams his hand on the paper and says, "Winged freak steals all of my press," and he's all upset about it. That's his real motivation to dislike Batman. His dislike for Bruce Wayne comes from the fact that he finds out that Wayne's dating Vale later on in the second act. But
well, that's – I mean, the Vicki Vale thing, yeah, comes before he knows
the boardroom Bruce scene, Wayne is.
But the boardroom scene would be right after that then.
The boardroom scene to me is shot the most – quote-unquote zany, or the most like a comic book film should be shot. There are some scenes in there that look like they could be panels out of a – and there's a pop zoom even at one point. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's scenes in there that have that kind of energy that most of the other movie doesn't have in it. I do like that scene in the boardroom.
Oh, except for the hand buzzer death is too much.
It's very campy. And which is funny to say campy in relationship to this movie, because they were going as far away from campy as they could, you know?
Yeah, people were probably horrified by it, right? But you watch it now and you think, oh, wow.
Now, of course, we come to the courtroom.
The courtroom scene, yeah. Now, this is where I start to have some issues. Because obviously, you know, Bob the Goon I love.
Who's, Tracy Walter is awesome. He's also the sidekick in Conan the Destroyer. So yeah, I thought this guy was real kick ass. I was a huge Tracy Walter fan when I was a kid.
So Bob the Goon's awesome. I think everyone can agree on that.
I had Bob the Goon Kenner action figure, by the way.
I believe it. But he's more badass than the Joker in this movie. But he's the number one henchman of the Joker, right? And he's always kind of been with him, even when he was Jack Napier. So you kind of get the sense that this guy does it to do it, you know. It's kind of his life and his lifestyle. But then you have this courtroom scene, and these mimes come out, right? And all of a sudden, the Joker has people who work for him. But who the fuck? What kind of professional hood is gonna dress up like a mime and do the whole mime thing, and then pull out their machine gun? It's too much for me.
I will say this. During the sequence, there is a shot where the mime looks at Michael Keaton and waves at him. And Keaton gives him a look like, fuck off. That is so exactly it's the best moment in the movie, in the moment for Keaton when he's not Batman, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. That look right there is exactly why he was right for this role at this time. And I recently had an argument with somebody who's actually older than I am. And he said that Bale was the best Batman. I said, to me, it's Keaton's the best Batman. And he says, no, Keaton was terrible. That's Mr. Mom. You know, and this guy is older than I am, so I was surprised to hear him say that, because I thought he would be a fan of Keaton having these movies. But I said to him, you know, whoever – it's kind of like James Bond. Whoever you grew up as your Batman is who you identify as that character.
Yeah.
So to me, Keaton really earned his stripes in that look, in that shot. That's my favorite shot in the whole sequence.
I love that he does – everyone else ducks. He doesn't duck. I mean, this is when Vicki Vale realizes – in my mind, she kind of starts piecing a lot of things together. And this is the scene that kind of damn near puts her over the edge into thinking that this guy's Batman.
Right. And this is also the portion where Bob the Goon is taking pictures of Vale for the Joker, and the Joker is now obsessed with Vicki Vale for no apparent reason.
He goes through what is he doing, by the way? He's cutting the pictures up, but what is he making something?
I never understood that either. And what's interesting is that he's got a file of hers it's a CIA declassified 1977 on it from her wartime files, and they're on the floor in a very Art Deco Tim Burton kind of way, and I've never understood what he was really doing there either, and I'm glad you brought that up.
There must be something that got cut out, right?
The fact that the file says 1977, this movie has an undefined time period, right? The goons dress like it's 1940s, well, the cops dress like it's the 70s.
Yeah, out of the late 30s pretty much.
But Bruce Wayne and Vicki Vale dress like it's 1980s. I mean, there's different characters dressed like it's different time periods. This thing almost exists in a parallel universe in a lot of ways. And it's evident this is a backlot on a lot of these shots, is it not? Especially when the Batmobile can't get up to speed, it looks like, in a couple of these shots on the short
road. No, this is shot – yeah. Well, this movie was shot in England, right, at Pine.
Pinewood Studio.
Yeah. So, yeah, you're right. It would have – they probably had just a little bit of road. Regardless, yeah. So this is the over a woman, are you insane again, right, thing that plays in again here. Almost immediately, the Joker's looking at Vale. He doesn't even realize that this is Bruce Wayne's deal, right? But he's flipping over a woman here already.
Yeah.
And in a way, isn't this kind of a mirror effect of so as he's becoming the Joker, right? Even before he gets his bandages off and everything, Bruce Wayne's fucking around with Vicki Vale, right? So he's kind of doing this stuff unbeknownst to him. The Joker is coming up and is going to be a big problem in his life, right? And now here you have the Joker noticing Vicki Vale, and Batman doesn't really know that the Joker is going to go after her.
Batman has nothing to do yet. This is the problem with this movie.
Batman has nothing to do with the whole movie.
Well, at this point, Batman still has no mission. I mean, the Joker has a mission. He wants he wants people to be terrified of him at least.
No one get the Joker? I mean, why don't they? He goes through a lot of TVs as well, but why don't they? Why doesn't anyone arrest the Joker?
Because he's an addict. I can't tell you. He's charismatic.
They don't. Everyone they just don't. It feels like the police force is not looking at the Joker at all, even after he poisons everyone, right? Which is coming up next, right? With the beauty products. He poisons the beauty products.
Yeah,
But no one goes to get him. No one's worried about it. No one's trying to hunt him down. They're all trying to hunt down Batman.
Well, he's not known as a criminal publicly until that courthouse step scene. And then
he's on TV as the killer. Right. But they still don't go after him.
The infamous part here is that they go – he interrupts the live news broadcast and becomes the big cosmetic scare, if you will. And this is a really strangely anti-consumer, anti-merchandise for a movie or a message in a movie that
anti-beautiful
is
anti-beautiful people?
Just anti-buying shit. Well? I mean, it's a movie about – at this point – the subplot is don't buy anything, and this is one of the most merchandise tie-in heavy movies of all time. It's bizarre when you look at it from that angle, you know.
But they do a funny thing with this, right? Where the newscasters no longer wear beauty products, and so they're all ugly in front of the camera.
But then they cut to way, Harvey Dent, who's slicker than shit. Lando Calrissian is looking good. I mean, everyone else.
Well, he refused, probably like, oh, we can't. He's like, no, I can't be seen like this. But in a way, that's what the Joker says. This town needs an enema. You know, and so he's taken away the beauty, and now everyone has to see, or he's taken off their masks in a way, right? Much the same way he kind of has to put on makeup all the time to look normal.
Yeah, it's the true face. It's everyone's true face is what I got out of it.
At this
point,
we're an hour in on the movie, and this is when, for me, I don't know about you, but for me, I was beginning thinking, fuck, this movie has another hour.
No, I actually, at this point, was looking forward to the next stuff that was coming up.
Really? I was like, oh, shit.
Because I do like then the sequence at the
museum?
Art museum.
Yes,
yeah, I do like that. Because of the fact that, A, it's odd that they have the Prince music cut into this, which I forgot that I had the companion soundtrack.
You're confused at what's odd. Again, we have these professional hoods and bad guys who are out robbing people, raping people, killing people, murdering, just heinous crimes. And they come in, yeah, listening to, and they paint on shit. They're like, woohoo! And you're like, what the hell is going on? Where did he find these freaks to do this stuff?
I think that the nice touch in this sequence is when she gets the little container with the gas mask on it. It says, put this on right now, that it's written in crayon.
I love the way that that's written. In urgent. I love the way. And the bow, you know, the attention to detail on the art side of this, yeah, is tremendous.
Especially the color structure that it matches the Joker's outfit. Yeah, all of that is very well planned out. This, and then, of course, is the big scene where Batman comes through the skylight, rescues Vicki Vale, and uses his wonderful toys, of course, as Jack Nicholson famously says.
Where does he get those wonderful toys? Yep, that's the very other famous line, right?
And that leads us into our first really appearance of that
Batmobile. Which is the best Batmobile ever, right? I mean, this is just, I wanted this so bad. I still want a Batmobile.
I would love to own this thing. I think it's the sleekest, sexiest version of the Batmobile they ever made.
It's got a jet engine on it. It has, you know, bombs on it. It's got, you know, oil slick, pretty much everything that the 60s one had, but cooler.
Let's go ahead and take a quick break and listen to what Siskel and Ebert said about Batman in 1989 from their original review. We'll come back with our further discussion of the second act of Batman from 1989.
I'm Roger Ebert of the Chicago Sun-Times.
And I'm Gene Siskel of the Chicago Tribune. Our first film is the eagerly awaited Batman. And although it's far from perfect, it's the first summer spectacular that I've really enjoyed. I think that has to do with it not being a sequel, and also that there's some true originality in the film's art design, sound, and performances. As been reported, this is a darker Batman, not at all like the campy 60s TV show. Director Tim Burton obviously wants to recall the original comic book look as well as tell a more adult kind of story. And that adult approach is what I found so refreshing about this Batman movie. We have so many films these days that are being made for the teenage audience, films that look like overblown TV shows. Here's a picture with adult stars, troubled characters, and a dark look. It's a shame that that approach has to be considered a risk these days, but I'm certainly glad the approach was taken. I enjoyed this Batman.
You said you enjoyed it more than any of the other entertainment pictures this summer. I certainly didn't think it was as much fun as the Indiana Jones film. As I looked at it, the thing that struck me most of all was the art direction. Gotham City in this movie is one of the original places in the movie. You know, I thought the special effects were good. I thought those buildings looked like they went up a mile and a half into the sky. I thought the dark film noir look of the film was very nice, but I didn't care about anything that happened in the movie. I never really found that these characters became people that I could get involved with. I felt that Nicholson, as the Joker, went on way too long. He was on too often. He was doing the same thing over and over. I found the relationship between Bruce Wayne and Vicki Vale didn't work at all. Kim Basinger and Michael Keaton.
The Bruce Wayne character was a fascinating guy.
All right, we're back from our break, and we're talking about the second half of 1989's Batman.
Do you want to talk a little bit about Roger Ebert? Because he does have one famous quote that I do know that he said about Batman in his review.
Which is?
Where he says, Batman is a triumph of design over story, style over substance, a great-looking movie with a plot you can't care much about. And that, to me, kind of sums up Tim Burton as a director.
I was always surprised that Siskel, though, was the one that really stuck up for this film and that Ebert didn't, because Siskel really was hard on these kind of movies a lot. In fact, that Ebert likes his character so much. Now, Ebert never gave any of these original Batmans a positive review. The first Batman movie he actually gave a thumbs up to is Batman Begins, and rightfully so.
Which, yeah, is unarguably the best Batman movie ever.
But for being a confessed comic book guy, he didn't really like these. And I was surprised, especially in hearing that clip just now, that Siskel was arguing that the characters and that he found these original characters and that they had a depth and a psychological complexity. Because I don't find that complexity anywhere in this movie, really. I'd be hard-pressed to really find the depth of character anywhere, especially now as we get into the second act and think about the relationship.
No, neither do I. But you know what, Tim Burton, if you ever hear Tim Burton discuss this movie, he does talk about it and he points to some things, but then I as well don't see it. Even he could point it out to me and spell it out to me like I was, you know, a 5-year-old, and I'd still wouldn't. I'd be like, nah, man, it's not there.
really, I think the jewel of this, the second half of the second act, if you will, then, you know, the next 30 minutes is the sequence in the apartment, in Vale's apartment, where we finally get the meeting between Wayne and the Joker, because we still haven't gotten much from Batman, because all he's done is show up and give them the cure for the cosmetic scare. Now things are right again, so they have to come up with some sort of problem. So he goes there to confess that he's Batman. Well-played scene. Wouldn't you agree that Keaton handles that scene very well?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so, too. And really, Basinger's right there with him in that scene for really not being noted for her acting talent really at the time. She was a model. I thought she was hanging in there with that sequence. But this scene is always nice to me because I like how Nicholson exits the scene. You know, how he throws himself away, and it just – it's got that weird energy to it that I wish that the scene where he shoots Palance had earlier in the in the movie. I wish it had – I wish this movie had more of that as I was watching it. What do you think is going on in this second half?
I think it was – this was just a run-out-the-clock situation at this point. I mean, this movie gets worse and worse the third act is just – is nonsense, right? It's just a waste of time, really.
The third act comes up with some sort of –
Well, are we really done with the second act?
No, let's progress.
I mean, whatever. I don't know what to say.
Now I'm thinking about the –
What big, I will you know. Say is that – okay, so back on what you were saying before, I will say this, that this movie does a good job of this and proves this, as do every other superhero movie since this, is that superhero movies are all about the reveal. Right. I mean, this movie is about reveal after reveal after reveal. And it kind of feels like you're on kind of an adventure in a way. Right. You're not really going anywhere, though.
But who decided that Jack Napier, that the Joker, was going to be the one that kills Batman's family? It's too small. It's too neat.
Tim Burton.
Tim Burton, of course, is the one. I mean, we know this from Kevin Smith's famous rants and whatnot. But Sam Hamm and Warren Scarp, who wrote this,
there was also a writer's strike, though.
I agree. I know.
And this is why I think is interesting about this and Transformers 2. You know, the ends of both of those movies are a complete of this and that are a nightmare.
The end of this movie, especially, or we'll get into that, but leading into
Let's
the third act.
This. There's a scene, though. What do you think, the ninja scene with the swords inspired by Indiana Jones at all?
I like that sequence, though, because it has to be. Yes, you're right, because it is.
Sure, but it does feel similar. That, like, maybe he kind of. I mean, it doesn't really necessarily play out with that same comedic, you know, outcome, but it is. It does feel like that to me, like, product of its time and a bit.
They need that scene, though, do they not? I mean, there's
Batman needs something to do. He needs to fight at some point, right?
Yeah. The thing is, when you watch the movie, you see how constricted his movement is in this first one. He's barely doing anything.
I mean, he doesn't move his, but it kind of plays out. I mean, when he has the Jack Napier in the chokehold, you know, before he's about in the Axis chemical plant at the very beginning of the movie, and he doesn't turn his head when the commissioner says, "Hey, you there, like, put him down." Anyway, he doesn't turn his head. In a way, it almost adds to that sense of he knows everything that's around him already. And to me, anyways, like, he's kind of he already knows, the commissioner's down there. He's just like some badass fighting guy who just knows what's going on around him. Is that just me, or?
It maybe added a little bit more to his mystique and his ninja quality.
I thought it did. I don't know. It's like one of those. It's a thing in action movies, right, where the guy like catches something without looking at it, or you know, blocks a kick that he's not looking at.
Hey, briefly, too. After this, we got the animated series, Batman: The Animated Series,
which is awesome.
Which this film. Is obviously the template for that, because this is the closest cinematic incarnation we ever got to that series. But
the only reason that happened was because of this movie.
100%. But I'm saying even the look of this and the time period and that noir aspect was lost in the further Batman films, and especially in the Nolan ones, which are all modern era.
Well, those are
technology
very,
and whatnot. Yeah. So,
to be fair,
the animated series is kick ass. I really think it's probably one of the seminal.
Though that
cartoons.
And you know, the X-Men series, of the 90s as well, was very good.
They did Mask of the Phantasm, which people are going to write into us and say as a topical point. But yes, you're right. But I'm saying as a movie, the closest they ever got to the look of the movies for that cartoon was this.
Yeah. This was clearly the inspiration, yeah.
And that beautiful score by Danny Elfman cannot be undervalued in what goes on by this. I mean, the mark.
I wish, dude, they don't open movies like this anymore, right? With just, you know, can you create excitement through just music and through some titles? You used to be able to. And this movie even did it to me. I mean, watching the opening to this, which is very similar to the opening to, you know, Star Wars or Superman.
I was going to say Star Wars 100. Seeing that Fox logo that leads into the Star Wars march, seeing that Warner Brothers logo morph into
excitement
the Danny Elfman
out
score.
Of nothing, right? I mean, it's absolutely nothing. But it's just that, yeah, hearing that and having that score and that theme, you know, play throughout the movie. Just kind of ties everything together.
Let's take a quick break and listen to Danny Elfman describe his process of creating that score.
In Batman, we wanted a single, very simple theme, unlike Beetlejuice or Pee-wee's Big Adventure or Midnight Run, which actually had several different themes which would run in different ways. In Batman, I wanted to approach it like an old-style film, almost like a 40s action movie would be. And I went for a single, very simple theme that I can play in a big way, in a small way, in a romantic way, or in a dark way. And so I just found that and played it for everybody, and they seemed to like it. And I just carried that throughout the movie. So it's your old-fashioned style, I think, of composition in that respect.
All right, so now we're still stuck in the second act of Batman from 1989.
Get me out!
And we cannot get this thing moving forward, so they have the confrontation at Vicki Vale's apartment, and now we're stuck with Bruce Wayne, who is supposedly dead in Napier's eyes, but he has come to the realization that Napier really killed his parents, so what can he do now? He's been shamed, he's now publicly humiliated.
Right.
Because Napier has challenged him.
You remember that? You ever dance with the devil by the pale moonlight?
I love that.
That was a line that stuck with me for a long time, yeah.
I thought it was very profound when I was a kid for some reason. I don't know why. It's really nonsense.
It really is. I know. It's just there. It's just there to finger him as the killer of his parents. But yeah, I don't know. And it's very comically re-said to the. It's almost like. I don't know if you, the way it's delivered by Keaton to the Joker at the end of the movie is almost a joke to me.
And is this movie not the third act, not all about greed, about playing on Gotham's vanity, greed? Mm-hmm. I mean, really the citizens of Gotham take a fucking beating in this movie. They really do. If you think about all this shit,
there's
they
not
must
a
endure.
Lot. There's actually not a lot of people that live in Gotham, right? Cause the Joker's like, I'm going to give away $20 million. I'll throw at the audience. There's no fucking audience at that parade. Where's the audience at?
Well, most people are in the bar watching the telecast.
There's almost nobody there. Yeah, Gotham has like a bar, a courthouse apparently, where a lot of shit goes down. And like an Axis chemical factory. There's really not a lot in Gotham.
I thought I saw Rocky Balboa jogging down the street with one shot. That's about it. You're right, though. There is a lack of extras in this movie. I don't know if that's a purposeful thing.
It feels like a small movie. It feels like a low budget, even though it's not. Well, I guess the budget's being spent on other things.
Yeah, a lot of it's being spent on other things, I believe. Do you know who was originally going to be cast in the role of Vicki Vale here? Slight trivia.
I don't know. I know that Bill Murray was going to be Batman.
And Eddie Murphy was going to be Robin at one point. Did you know that?
Yeah. Okay, who was going to be Vicki Vale? Ooh, well, Sean Young. At the time, wouldn't have been bad.
No, and she was involved in a horse riding accident, so she was recast with Kim Basinger. This is why Sean Young was so adamant to try to get that Catwoman part in the sequel, which she was unsuccessful at.
Oh, good Lord. She crazy. She
crazy. Now, you brought up Bill Murray, and I brought up Eddie Murphy as Robin, but there is
Ivan Reitman. Could you – I mean, if you could say Ivan Reitman is directing Batman, I'd say, good Lord, give me Tim Burton any day.
Yeah, I would not have wanted to see that. There'd be nothing in that I could pot that would even have held up. And this barely holds up. Can you imagine that?
Yeah.
In 2015. But there is a merciful lack of Robin in this, and I applaud them for not including Robin in this film.
Well,
I mean,
originally
the temptation must
have
been, I know, and the temptation to keep must have been great, but I'm glad they didn't.
Again, due to the writer's strike, right? He was cut out.
Thank goodness. Now, but now we're stuck in the movie, and we have Batman being or Bruce Wayne being challenged.
We are stuck in the movie
to this $20 million giveaway and come out fight mano a mano. And I never understood this because what were they supposed to do? Literally have a fist fight? I mean, this really was a lose situation.
Well, we do have that. Did the Batcave scene happen already?
No, I mean the second Batcave scene.
No,
the Vicky Vale is led into the cave scene,
right?
Which happened. That's the second reveal,
which is a lot of people have issues with, and I think is interesting because I never notice, I never think about it, I guess, but it is true that Alfred did just let her down there with, and he does not, he doesn't even know that she knows that he's Batman.
You know, Sam Hamm, who you said earlier was part of the writer's strike, sure, who was involved in this. I remember seeing a documentary where he said he was not, once again, he did not write that. And he said if he, as far as he's concerned, that is Alfred's last day of employment at Wayne Manor.
Well, it would be true. I mean, I never noticed, or I still didn't notice it this time watching it. I just never catch it, I guess.
Isn't it part of the Batman package, though, in these early ones? Isn't every woman realize he's Batman at some point during the film?
Sure. It is weird that she shows up suddenly and he doesn't. It does feel like there's a scene missing because he just kind of doesn't. She shows up and he's like, oh, hey, what's up? It's like she just showed up in your Batcave. Like, that's not cool.
No, I mean, how did she find out? I mean, this is supposed to be secret.
What's up?
I want to check that security.
I mean,
situation.
You did take her there once before, but, you know,
Stage 5
just be showing up. This is my Batcave.
You never leave me.
He keeps his suit in the craziest contraption of a safe.
I'm not really sure if that's necessary to keep it like in an air safe vault.
The one thing that this movie, I mean, it's cool he's got a Batcave, but it is, after seeing other Batcaves, it leaves a lot to be desired, doesn't it? There's really not much to his Batcave. He's got some TVs, which apparently are just cameras. It's just apparently the surveillance system to his mansion. That's what his Batcave is.
It looks like it's like a floating catwalk.
Everything else he does, well, when he, you know, when he Googles, if you will, or he asks Alfred for a file, he just gets it in his office upstairs. He doesn't even use his Batcave.
Yeah, he is in his office quite a bit more than his Batcave. Let's talk about the cathedral. Because that is, I don't want to talk about the cathedral. I want to talk about the attack on the street. Because I think the Batwing, when they did
Well, the Batwing's awesome.
The Batwing, this was the best part of the movie.
Again.
It still is the best part of the movie. That sequence where he's coming down and through the streets, mm-hmm, and he takes the balloons, and of course he goes up to the moon.
What a perfectly designed vehicle as well for Batman to have, right?
Oh, yeah. It makes sense, doesn't it? It's like, out of all of his vehicles.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Batmobile looks like a Batmobile. The Batwing looks like a Batwing. It's like everything that he has, you're just like, yeah, that's Batman shit right there.
There's a synergy to all his shit, and I like it. Mm-hmm. I like it. There's consistency. The iconic shot against the moon is to me like, sure, this movie. You know what I mean? I saw that, and I kind of smiled myself. Like,
which is the Pepsi
of course
commercial.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Of course, that's exactly what it should look like right there. And then when he comes back down, what I could never understand is this. When he comes back down and he's going through the alleyway and the Joker's on the big float standing there defiantly, is he missing on purpose? Is he trying to hit the Joker?
I don't know because Batman, while he does kill people in this, doesn't kill people.
He's not ever – that's the whole idea.
But at this point, he knows that Jack Napier –
Killed his family,
and he does in the end say that he wants to kill him. So I don't know, but he killed people at that. Remember, you know, so he goes to the prelude to this is that he blows up the Axis chemical plant, right?
Right.
Or he sends the Batmobile in to do it. And he kills people there though, because those people didn't have enough time to run away from the bombs.
But he does. They're collateral damage. That's not really like a kill situation.
I mean, the Joker could easily have shot him as well from the helicopter.
But doesn't.
Yeah. See, it actually flies away. He wants to fight Batman, but instead at that point he flies away because the movie has half an hour more to go to make its running time, apparently. And then he has to do his $20 million giveaway. So, yeah, this is where, to me, this is where the movie completely falls apart. And
right,
as far as I understand it, due to the writing problems and Tim Burton coming up with things and other people actually not even having a script through some of this stuff. The cathedral, I mean, there's a famous story where Jack Nicholson even turns to Tim Burton and asks, like, why am I going up the steps of this cathedral? Like, what are we going to do at the top? And Tim Burton basically having to admit that he had no fucking idea.
Whereas I hear a secondary version of that story where Jack Nicholson and Peter Gruber, the producer, went and saw Phantom of the Opera one night and were so taken aback by the end of that that takes place at the cathedral that they decide this is how we have to end our movie. So somewhere between those two stories probably lies a mixture
again,
of truth. And that's how we come up with
you have the
ending.
Original script being thrown out.
Which is why this is so some, now. You literally get the feel of the wheels
turning. It keeps going on and on. I mean, the point, you have to admit, he throws the Joker off. I mean, this is kind of the culmination of this whole thing. He throws the Joker off the ledge, and then Joker reaches up and grabs them, and then throws them off the ledge. You're like, holy shit, they should just keep having ledges. Like, then he should throw the Joker off a ledge, and the Joker throw them off another ledge, and they just
like
keep going down.
Because
at this
cartoon.
Point, we're just going on and on, you know?
And really, it's spinning its wheels, particularly when he looks up and says, give me 5 minutes to the top. He says, better give me 10. You think, my goodness, here we go. but this all does come together with I think, the actual death of the Joker when they find the body
hit
the chattering of the teeth and the laughter.
Wouldn't you agree?
I think that works.
There's something that is solved in movies nowadays was a problem for me with movies back in, you know, 30 years ago or whatnot. Where they don't up the ante in the fights. Like, the fight sequence at the end of this is just, eh.
Because there's not a real physical confrontation there. What could they do?
Well, exactly. But they could have done something, you know? To say, what could they do? They could have done a lot.
I think that they knew they had a... They knew they had a problem with the actual physical confrontation between the two, because that's why they had Bruce Wayne slash Batman going through all those fights on his way to the top, you know, in kind of this Game of Death Bruce Lee type way of each level there's a new bad guy and you finally get to the Joker. And then you get there and like you said, they should have upped the ante and this be like the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar to Bruce Lee fight. But now there's nothing. And all he does is, like you said, throw him off a ledge, and he throws him off a ledge, and he throws him, you know, gets him basically
they
trapped onto a gargoyle.
Lost the idea of art over an action yet, you know, at this point, as far as big budget movies go, you know, because obviously this is the end of the 80s. We've had plenty of great action films throughout there, but a lot of them have been smaller. And it took a while. Through the 90s really is when it really – took full effect, right? Where we got real action, we got real B movie action pushed up into the A level.
This is, I think, you could point to Batman in a lot for a lot of things as being a first, and I think this isn't obviously the first, but I think on a grand scale, you can see it, and it affected many blockbusters after. Is that the third act goes on autopilot, and it's really it's just not an honest to goodness
so
third
long.
Act. There's,
it's a
there's
real
nothing
long third
there.
Act.
I think the last half of the third act is really long. Like I said, from the point that Batman crashes to the time that him and Joker face off, you could basically cut all that out. There's
the
nothing
long
in
gun
there
was,
to say.
I liked that. I always remember that as a kid.
Yeah, I thought that was
that
very
was fun,
that,
right?
Stays with that loony kind of aspect the movie could use more of. You know, I keep saying
I'm not sure how it took down the Batwing. That always got me, but.
I'm not even sure where you get bullets for that sumbitch, but or how you even transport it. But it worked. It worked in that moment. But the ending now. Let's talk about the ending. The Joker's dead. Batman has now. You know, I love the Commissioner. I really think the epilogue in this movie works. I think from the point they find Nicholson with the laughing box to our final fade out, that all works. I think that all is really solid. What do you think about that last 3 minutes or so?
Yeah, it's all good, but it just reminds me that whole thing reminds me. Where's Gordon? Where are all these people that should be doing things? And I'm sitting here watching people twiddle their thumbs.
Well, especially because in the opening act, especially with Gordon coming after him in the chemical plant before Napier turns into the Joker, he says, you know, apprehend that man, keep a lid on it, like it's going to be the police after Batman, which they never explore again. Until that final
the police
sequence.
Police do nothing in this movie. They're hardly even in the damn movie, except, as you say, they're at the bar.
Right.
They
collecting
are at
cash
the bar.
From the giveaway. In any movie that uses, you know, the I'm going to gas the city, it cracks me up. I mean, that's the Joker's plan, is to gas the city outside.
I love that no one figured it out. I mean, Vicki Vale only figured it out after there was gas leaving the balloon.
Right, and good thing she had a teleporter
it's
lens.
Like, nobody else could see that, yeah.
Of course, this is the last sequence is when Commissioner Gordon was reading to the crowd, and they say he gave us the signal, and they do that magnificent pull up.
The signal's awesome.
The grand score at that point, really just the big kind of overbearing theatrical operatic score.
Although
there,
I often wonder, they do have the scene where I wonder what if Vicki Vale hadn't turned around and noticed Alfred was there waiting for her. She would have just kept walking down the street. I mean, Alfred doesn't even call out to her. What kind of a butler is that?
I've always enjoyed the way that Burton ended these two Batman films, and they did the same kind of trick with, if you remember, in the second one, at the end with Keaton in the car, and they pan up and Catwoman's up there. But this one set really the standard for those shots, those iconic shots that Nolan would later then up the ante on with his shots of Batman on ledges and hanging on shit and things like that. So really a hell of a way to go out. I mean, the movie starts well and ends well, but I thought overall underwhelming in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I agree. The second one's a far better movie. I hope. I haven't seen that in a long time. I always watch this one in anticipation of watching the second and never do, and always say, oh, the second one's so much better. I hope I don't eat my words when I finally get around to seeing the second one.
My memory, to back you up in that point, is that this is very much like the first Star Wars to me, where I hear dialogue and it's almost like old music. Like, you know what I mean? It rings a bell and everything kind of has its own cadence.
Sure.
The second one is the gem to me, you know, Empires
or finer detailed or finer, you know, laser focused. It's a little less meandering, you know. You can tell that they have it down by that second movie.
And I think the trial and error of the first film and what worked and what didn't, and the confidence all around, and maybe even just the lack of pressure, although the second one is really different in a lot of ways. I mean, time period wise, it seems to all be of a certain time period, different than the first one. And they don't if you look at them together, if there was only one in Batman and Batman Returns, they never did Forever and Batman and Robin, and you just had those two Burton ones, they don't even feel like true sequels to one another, because there's no connective tissue between the two other than the fact that they kept some of the base actors. But I always felt that the second one was the superior one, actually my favorite of the first four.
Yes, I would agree.
Well, the absolute blitz of marketing that accompanied this thing was out of control in the summer of 1989.
To say the least.
To say the least is right. Now,
I loved it.
A shitload.
Boy, wasn't
of this
that
stuff.
Wasn't that a time to be a kid?
Oh, this was the time to be.
It's
a kid
nothing. People don't understand. It's nothing like it is today. I mean, we've shared some stuff that Disney's been doing. They really, you know, up the ante in today's world as far as tie-ins and whatnot for advertising and all that stuff. But back then, it was big name brands on, you know, big spots on TV. It was really everywhere, in your face.
All day, every day, especially on any kid-friendly channels that sold.
And there was only like one movie during that, you know, time that they were doing this with. You know,
yeah,
and
now it's
switch
every
off.
Other weekend.
Now it's every like fucking movie. Yeah, Burger King's got, you know, this movie, and, you know, McDonald's has this movie. And so it's all over the place. But this was really, you know, broadly focused on one movie across the board. It was crazy.
We're going to take a quick break and let you listen to a couple of vintage commercials. One is a Diet Coke ad that accompanied the VHS cassette of Batman when it was released on home video back in 1989. Also a Taco Bell commercial and a Batman the Cereal commercial. So enjoy this, and we'll be right back with our further thoughts on the marketing blitz of the Batman film.
Hello. Gotham Corner Store? Yes, we seem to be down to our last Diet Coke. A gentleman is on his way to pick some up. Just look for a black car. No, this black car will be rather difficult to miss. And by the way, the gentleman is usually in quite a rush.
Just for the taste of it.
Now at Taco Bell, you can collect free Batman cups, like a free Batmobile cup, or a free Batwing cup. Four cups in all, free, with free refills and free cinnamon twists every time you buy a 32-ounce drink at Taco Bell.
I want you to tell all your friends about me. I'm Batman.
Continues now with Batman the Cereal, and nothing can slow him down. Nothing can stop him from bringing it to you. It's here. A smashing taste. A honey nut flavored part of your complete breakfast. Batman cereal.
So you were saying that it was a great time to be a kid back then because all the stuff you could get, all the toys. And let's quickly talk about
wonderful toys.
such wonderful toys they had because that was the
key. Goodness.
I saw a couple of these on YouTube and just looking at them, they hit memory banks and I thought, I wanted this shit. I look at it now and I still want to hunt it down on Amazon somewhere, you know, because it was that built in that demand for it. Nicholson famously had a bit of the action here, and he is quoted as saying that Warner Brothers themselves underestimated the demand here, and that their supply wasn't great enough to fuel the demand, and that he lost quite a bit of coin in that transaction. Now, he still made $70 million. That's a 1989's figure, so. Mm-hmm. Do that in today's math off his cut from the merchandising because he took a back end deal. So he is can be credited to having some sort of glimpse of the juggernaut that this would become. But that logo and was everywhere from hats to t-shirt. I mean, you couldn't walk 10 feet without seeing somebody in some sort of Batman.
A nice yellow bat logo.
I mean, I personally had the Batman logo on some Chuck Taylor Converse sneakers. I had it on a t-shirt. I had it on a ball cap. How much Batman shit did you own at one point?
I didn't have a lot of stuff. No. I did not have that much Batman stuff.
No, I was.
I didn't have a lot of stuff to begin with, but I really liked. I was always into G.I. Joe. That was my.
That was your.
Those
thing?
Were the things. Those and Ninja Turtles. Obviously a little later than this.
I was always a He-Man guy myself.
He-Man. Yeah, I did have all the He-Man. Yeah.
I did, looking at these commercials, I did have Bob the Goon, like I was saying, as the action figure.
Yeah, Bob, I remember that action figure.
The Batman, and then the Joker character as well. So those did me
yeah,
over.
Oh. You're right. I mean, I had the Batman and Joker.
What I did have figures. From this was the Batman, the collector's trading cards, which were big.
Yes, I had the
trading cards.
I had those, and I also got the Batman 2 ones when those came out.
Yes, the glossy ones that were Upper Deck. Remember that?
Nice.
It's a card collector. Remember Upper Deck line, and they were nice. I still have them.
You're going to make me have to look for mine. Yeah, I might still have mine as well.
I think mine have my Dick Tracy cards in there, too, to pull out my Nerdomatic a little further, you know? Yep, don't judge.
I don't. I like those cards for whatever reason. I don't even know. They're completely stupid, but...
They were very calming to me for some reason.
Yes.
I don't know why. They calmed me. Yeah, they had 132 cards in that original set by Topps, 1989. And I'm sure you can find those at most WonderCon or comic conventions now, but they were...
They were everywhere, yeah.
They were everywhere back there.
I don't even remember how I got them.
Let's talk about the VHS. We did it a long time ago.
This
was
a huge release.
This was a huge release. You and I talked a long time ago on a podcast. I can't remember the exact number, but we talked about the most owned... store-bought videotapes of all time. And we put Home Alone in there, Wayne's World. But this one is right up
there. You know, the difference between the other ones, this one doesn't show up as much because it's so old. I bet they broke or whatnot. But, I mean, we were talking about it. We were talking about VHSs that show up in secondhand stores right. and whatnot. And it's usually, you know, Jurassic Park. Things in the 90s, like you say... Home Alone stuff, but not a lot of the original Batman stuff, and I bet they were just too old.
Because these tapes,
a lot of people own this shit.
These tapes sold by the millions, and this movie was infamous at the time for shrinking the window from theatrical to DVD or home video, I should say VHS at the time. Nowadays, it's commonplace 3-4 months after to have this available on demand. At the time in 1989, this was
they didn't
outlandish.
Do it much after this.
It would take, I remember, it would take a year, literally 6 months to 8 months to get it onto videotape. And about 6 months after that, it would start being on HBO. And then about a year after that, it would be on network television. So there was a year lag there.
When you think about, I mean, the amount of screens this came on, this was a wide release. And we have twice as many screens now. It would be a normal wide release for a movie like this. Mm-hmm. So it kind of takes a trickle down. For it to play the whole country, right? And they still at that point, even in the late 80s, they liked to do, even though VHS was around, it was still not uncommon to do revival playings and showings in theaters, and people would still go.
This debuted June 19th, 1989 in theaters, and it made its home video debut November 15th, 1989. So as you can see, a very small
which
window.
Which helped it probably make a shitload of more sales.
And the intent was to break E.T. sale record at the time of 15 million units and to get it out for the Christmas holiday. We have here a special news clip of the VHS, the day that the VHS was released and the hysteria that was caused, followed by a Warner Brothers holiday commercial to get you to buy this. $24.95 was the first time that I can remember seeing one of these sold at a quote-unquote sell-through, meaning that you wasn't priced at $100, wasn't priced for rental, was priced for sale, so you get it for your family. So enjoy this. We'll be right back is further talking about the impact that this VHS had on us.
Batman is the earliest video release for a major movie yet, reaching the stores only 4 months after its theatrical debut and upsetting many of the country's smaller theater chain operators who are still playing Batman on the big screen.
We were concerned and that we were, you know, disappointed that they did move up the release window on Batman.
The ill will with some theater owners was obviously a calculated risk taken with bigger stakes in mind, namely cashing in on the Christmas gift market by presenting the Batman cassette as an ideal stocking stuffer, all in hopes that E.T.'s all-time home video record of 15 million copies sold will be broken by the Caped Crusader and his arch enemy with the Nasty Lab.
Want the movie of the decade.
Who's this guy?
The smash hit of the season.
I'm Batman.
Can somebody tell me what kind of world we live in where a man dressed up as a bat gets all of my press?
Batman on video cassette. The gift you want to give. The gift they want to get. Specially priced at stores everywhere.
I don't know about you, but I watched this tape maybe more times than any other store-bought tape that we owned. This and Top Gun were the ones that we had. These were
Wayne's World. Two that we had.
Yeah, Wayne's World. Okay, yeah.
Encino Man.
Well, see, I didn't have either.
I watched
of those
really
on
bad
tape.
Comedies, and that's what I watched the most. If I'm talking about rewatchability,
I had Rocky IV and Rambo
that's
taped off
one,
HBO,
though.
And Conan
yeah, I had Star
taped
Wars
off
taped
HBO.
Off.
But CBS. We only owned Top Gun and Batman at the time. So those are the two that
those
I've seen.
Those are extremely rewatched. I mean, Top Gun, I don't know about this movie, but Top Gun, hell yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, the problem is I've seen both of those too many to the point where I don't have to ever watch them again. I probably got them on yeah. memory. It's like Terminator 2.
Yeah.
But yeah, this VHS, as you hear, was intended to sell millions. I don't think it broke E.T.'s record. From what I can gather, the only data I got is that it sold 11 million units through January of 1990. So in a short space there, sold 11 million copies. And what I recall is that The Lion King, I want to say, for some reason, sold 24 million units. I want to say it was like the all-time best-selling VHS tape mm-hmm. until Titanic came along, which if you ever go to like a Rasputin's, you could see.
Joe's Titanic tapes everywhere.
There will never be a shortage of Titanic tapes, but like nah. You could float on them. He could erase the Titanic on those. But yeah, the Batman though, you know, all these years later, it's easy to dismiss it as of its time and corny and this, that, and the other.
Do you think
but
the technology at all hurts this? I mean, it doesn't for me or for you. We grew up in this time. He does have, you know, a key fob for the Batmobile that understands him. He can speak, you know, shields. You know, stop, you know, he can drive it around, do all that kind of stuff with it. To me, that kind of glossed over the whole missing cell phone and all that other kind of technology, computers and stuff.
That's funny you brought up the missing cell phone. I thought about that in the scene early on when Eckert's talking to Napier first and Bob the Goon pulls a gun on him. And I just thought, I like the fact that nobody's texting anyone. Nobody's getting recorded without their knowledge. Like there's
everything's file-based, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, hard copy-based. Nothing is – there's no computers at all. I mean, there's not even computers in the Batcave. There's, like I say, it's like closed-circuit television. That's all he's got.
Well, the Batcave has the most sophisticated security ever. I mean, the newspaper itself is straight out of the 1930s. They have literally like little file shelves that, with letters on them.
Yeah, so the Batmobile and the Batwing obviously are the most technological of things that he has. And like I say, because of that, I don't know, to me, he can talk into the key fob, you know, boop, boop, and set his alarm on his Batmobile. It does feel to be that kind of glosses over, kind of almost makes it a little modern age, which in 89, that's some pretty crazy shit.
Oh, yeah. When the Batmobile got the canopy over it, I thought that was just the greatest, you know. I even thought it looked good. back then. It looks terrible.
Well,
now.
Even when he sends it in to bomb the Axis chemical plant at the end, and it comes and it drives back to him, and you realize, oh shit, it did that on him. He wasn't even in the car.
Did you notice that the Batmobile is left-handed driving on the left-handed side? I'm sorry, on the right-hand side.
Yeah, I know it's English. Well, it was
filmed in England. It's one of those things where that's the giveaway that it's filmed across seas. You know that Batman jumps in on the wrong side of the car. And
he's
then they
Batman. He's weird.
Yeah, he is weird in this movie. That's kind of the whole Batman thing. You know, I want to briefly bring up that you and I saw this 10 years ago now, over 10 years ago, on the big screen at a revival down in Westlake in Southern California, and it played very well on the big screen. It played actually better on the. I thought it played better on the big screen than it just played for me here on DVD.
Especially since it was a very used and loved 35mm print.
Oh, that thing had – that looked like it was a grindhouse print with scratches.
Which just made it – to me, made it so much better.
It felt like I was watching a film noir type – it felt like we rediscovered something in a way, didn't it?
Yes.
We thought, I'm like, yeah. That was a very loved print. You're being generous there. I think it had cigarette burns up the yin-yang on it. Do you want to add anything else on our closing moments here of our retrospective, our first retrospective?
No, I think we have discussed in total detail everything about Batman. You know, I would just, if some guy pulls up to you and asks you to go into his bat cave, I'd be a little weary. That's all. I'll leave you with that.
All I know is that Kim Basinger weighs a little bit more than 105, okay?
No, I don't know. She's pretty skinny. She's pretty small.
Yeah, I mean, I'm honestly though, Kim Basinger's best movie by far. Right?
Yeah, she's in other movies. You saying?
And you wonder if there was any problems on set.
I mean,
because
Sells pretty good
with Nicholson and Keaton again, but never Basinger again. So you always wonder about that.
Sell.
Well, that's going to wrap up our retrospective tonight. We want to thank you guys for joining us on this special episode. We'll be looking forward to doing other films. If you have requests for any films you'd like to hear us do, and they are some of our favorites, we'll get around to doing those as well. I know we have a Lethal Weapon one in the pipeline, so look forward to that. Speaking for Robin, that's Mr. Trevor Anderson. I am Batman, Mr. Jason Rugard.
Why am I Robin?
We are the dynamic duo because you're the swinging dick. You're swinging Dick Grayson.
I'll be Bob the Goon, all right?